Welcome back to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast. I'm Dr. Michaela Benson, a reader in sociology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and the research lead for a UK and a Changing Europe funded project that's all about what Brexit means for British citizens living in the EU 27. Today, I'm joined by Alia Ahad of Migration Policy Institute, and we're going to focus on a topic that I know that some people have been thinking about recently, which is the topic of British families and children. I don't think that we really talk about this very much. So I'm really pleased that Alia has published a brief report on this topic. It was actually published back last autumn, but I don't think it's had as much circulation as I would have liked to see it. It's got some great stuff in it, so I'll post the link in our show notes as well. I thought I'd start, Alia, by asking you, what do we mean when we say British families?
There's a kaleidoscope of family arrangements for British nationals living in the EU 27. And I mean, it's very diverse in terms of the age profiles, the sexual orientation of the partners, as well as, you know, the living arrangements, whether they are third country nationals or dual, triple nationality family members, etc. And there's quite limited data to actually evidence these profiles. For example, we know how many British nationals are living in the EU 27 or British citizens are living there, but we don't know how many third country national family members are attached to these different British nationals. So what we're dealing with is a population that we know is diverse, but we don't know exactly how.
Do we have any sense of any numbers that might help us at all?
Yeah, so we do have figures on the number of children, for example, under the age of 15. There are 66,000 living in the EU 27, but they're spread very differently between member states. So for example, there are 36% of the UK nationals living in Slovakia are children under the age of 15, and 37% in Lithuania, whereas that number can be much lower in other member states. And it's worth noting that the largest number of children in general, or British children, live in Spain, which has the biggest population of UK citizens in the EU 27 as a whole.
That's really interesting, because that really isn't what we imagine, as we've discussed before, when we think about British citizens who live in Spain. Okay, so why do you think it's important that we pay attention to this broadly conceived set of British families when we're thinking about British citizens who live in Europe?
There are a number of issues that British families in particular are going to face after Brexit, largely around residency and entry requirements. So the withdrawal agreement, if it ever comes to pass, we'll still wait on the verdict on that. But the withdrawal agreement is broadly generous in the different categories of family members who are protected. So for family members who are already living in the EU 27 and exercising free movement rights, they will be allowed to stay. And also it protects family members who live abroad, but who are either spouses or partners, dependent children, grandchildren, and the sort of primary family members, or the group that is categorized as being primary family members under the Free Movement Directive. Even now, with the Free Movement Directive and before the UK has Brexited, there are a number of issues that families in particular face, and they have been historically the ones who find it most difficult to exercise free movement, particularly when they're third country national family members trying to do so, because they can face unnecessary visa restrictions or wrongful refusals or administrative burdens. And the people who are making decisions on whether third country national family members get their visas under the Free Movement Directive don't always know how to implement that directive correctly. So the council, the British council in Pakistan, the particular officer working there may not be as familiar with the Free Movement Directive as they should be, which could lead to that family member not having the access in the same way that they should have under the letter of the law.
I think this is really interesting, and I think that it probably deserves a little bit more attention, because my understanding of what you're saying is that at the moment, there are already existing known problems with permitting the free movement of some families under the terms of the law. So actually what the law looks like when it's practiced is quite different to what some of the people who are administering it understand it to be. And I think it all also highlights one of the things that I've been really interested in, which is actually who free movement works for and how, which, as we know, now fast forwarding to thinking about Brexit, some of the ways in which that has been functioning or not functioning will also impact disproportionately on people in respect to Brexit. I don't know if that's really clear, but basically, if people have struggled to exercise free movement for a variety of reasons, I think that this makes them much more vulnerable to whatever Brexit will bring.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and especially for people who are out of work, so family members who have taken time off to care for other family members, they are de facto legally resident in the different EU27 member states, but they may at the same time not fulfill the legal requirements of having sufficient resources or being active in the labor market. So those particular groups can get caught out from this. And I think more broadly, if the UK were to leave the EU without a deal, then UK nationals will become third country nationals quite suddenly with a bit of a thud. And they would then be subject to the rules on family reunification for third country nationals, which are far less generous than those that are guaranteed under the EU Free Movement Directive, and which would be also applied to UK nationals currently in the EU under the withdrawal agreement.
Do you want to just explain a little bit more what those are? Because this is a mechanism called the Surinder Singh route, I think, is what you're talking about here, which I think some people will have heard of, but may not really fully understand the details of.
So there are lots of components to this. I think what I meant specifically under the family reunification rules for third country nationals was that the sponsor sometimes has to fulfill different language requirements, income requirements, housing requirements, whereas under the Free Movement Directive, they don't have to meet those things. But what you've mentioned is an excellent point, and that will also be something that ceases for UK nationals once they are no longer EU nationals, and that's the Surinder Singh rights, which effectively allows EU citizens who have exercised free movement, so a British person who moves to France and marries someone or has their partner join them there, then they are allowed to return to their home country without having to meet whatever requirements that home country might impose on other nationals. So for example, in the UK, there's an income requirement when you want to bring your spouse, your third country national spouse to join you. I think it's £30,000 or something like this. But if you're a British person who has exercised free movement rights, you don't have to meet that same income requirement. That will cease for UK nationals after Brexit, and that could be potentially harmful in the case where there are British families who are unable to maintain themselves either in the EU27 or to reunify and return to the UK. They might be forced to split up or in some way separate, which could lead to a lot of economic hardship and exacerbate vulnerability.
This is particularly about British nationals who are married to third country nationals at this point in time. And you're pointing to European Union law, really, in respect to judging who can return under those routes. Do you think that there are particular issues relating to children that are worth drawing attention to? What does Brexit mean for these children? How can we understand or make sense of this?
There are issues that will affect children in particular, whether there is a deal or no deal. So, for example, if there is a deal under the withdrawal agreement, family reunification for future family members is not covered. You can bring an existing family member who might happen to live elsewhere. They can still join you in your host EU27 member state. But if you haven't met your spouse yet on the day of Brexit, then you're kind of out of luck, which for these 66,000 children under the age of 15, one would assume that they're not in a relationship or a relationship that will result in family reunification. So they are at a disadvantage when it will come to wanting to form families later on in life. They'll be subject to the sometimes harsher national legislation as opposed to being covered by EU legislation. So that's one thing. But more generally, children will be dependent on their guardian to fulfill whatever post-Brexit application requirements there are. And I mean, dependent on them administratively and financially. So if a parent wrongfully assumes that because their British child was born in a member state, for example, that they don't need to register, then that child will be really at a severe loss later on if they want to then apply for permanent residency or citizenship because they haven't fulfilled the necessary requirements. Now, I think it's also important to think about the fact that there will be British children who are in the protection of the state within member states. And they have been, you know, I don't know the figures on the size of this population, but of course, where there are children, there are also instances where those children need to be in the protection of the state. And the state will then be also responsible for making sure that they fulfill the post-Brexit status requirements. And I don't know if that's on the horizon or minds of member states at this point when they're thinking about implementing a deal. So those are some major issues related to children. I think the last one that I'll touch on will be particularly in the case of no deal. The system that currently exists for recognizing maintenance and care requirements for children will no longer exist. So currently, if there's a British mother, for example, and her son living in Italy, and the British father is living in the UK, if that father were to suddenly stop paying the maintenance requirements that have been ordered through the courts, then the parent only has to go to their local court in order to have those orders enforced. And so that reduces the administrative hassle, reduces the cost, and makes it easier to maintain those orders across borders. But once the UK is no longer in the EU, that legal framework will disappear. And so it will become much more complex and tricky for parents to enforce these maintenance orders between the UK and the EU27, which could also result in economic hardship for children who are caught in the middle of this.
And you said that's particularly in the case of no deal.
Yeah, that would be in the case of no deal because there's no legal framework proposed or examples given of which court will be responsible for what. So that would just disappear overnight.
I think that you've raised a set of issues that other people have been concerned about, particularly to do with children who are in the protection of the state, but also to do with actually, you know, things that make everyday life much more straightforward for separated and transnational families, which in the case of Brexit clearly presents a significant challenge to some of those. And I think that the intricacies that you highlight and the kind of the nuances of that will only become more visible when we actually know what's going to happen. I just wondered, there is something, isn't there, about children's rights and, well, within human rights law, I believe, that frames part of this discussion as well.
Yeah, so there's the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which, I mean, one would hope would lead to a higher level of protection for children and doing actions that are in the best interest of children. So that is something that member states as signatories are supposed to uphold. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that on the ground implementation will still be particularly favorable for British children caught in the crosshairs of Brexit.
I think that's a really important point about how law is one thing in principle and can be quite a different thing in practice. And I think that's what we really do need to hold at the forefront of our minds when we think about what Brexit might mean for people, because what it looks like it might mean on paper might not actually be what it means in practice.
Yeah, and I think that's also a good point when we're considering other compositions of families, for example, same-sex couples who, you know, technically within the directive on free movement are allowed to exercise free movement if they can evidence that they're in a durable relationship. So, I mean, for those who aren't married, if you're married, there is actually European Court of Justice case law that will allow same-sex marriages to exercise free movement, even in member states where same-sex marriage is not recognized. That case happened last year. But for same-sex couples who are not married, who are just in a registered partnership or unregistered partnership, they have to prove the durability of their relationship. And what that means in different member states varies in terms of the requirements, the evidence that they have to supply. In some member states, you have to show that you've been living together, which can obviously disadvantage long distance couples. We have to show that you've, you know, seen each other for a certain number of days out of the year. And all of these things could become much more difficult after Brexit. And moreover, if there's no deal and UK nationals are suddenly subject to the Third Country National Family Reunification Directive, that does not have the same threshold of protection for same-sex couples.
That reminds me of some work I did many years ago, which was about the British government and its approaches to spousal visas. And what was really fascinating about it and what you said that reminded me of this was actually, as soon as you start to put in place requirements for people to demonstrate a kind of a genuine relationship, you also introduce a huge number of assumptions about what a relationship is, which can be quite exclusionary for people who practice relationships differently. So there's a lot of judgment that goes into that, which on the surface of things, you kind of say, well, you know, okay, so they've got to have some rules, but those rules actually reinforce particular understandings of relationships that might not be held out in practice. And I think that's a really central and important point when we're starting to talk about who is a family, all of those types of things. I just wondered if you had any thoughts on issues to do with future care. So future care in respect to transnational families, what the withdrawal agreement actually says about this. So, for example, there are cases that we know of where, you know, at the moment the families might live in two or three member states, and there might be future care needs either for the elderly or for children that require the movement of the extended family for reunification purposes, I suppose. I'm not entirely clear in my head where we're at with the withdrawal agreement in respect to that.
Well, under the terms of the withdrawal agreement, only future family reunification is allowed for primary family members. So that doesn't include non-dependent parents or non-dependent siblings or any of these people who currently probably perform a large caregiving role. And indeed, this could be one of the significant negative impacts of Brexit if family members are no longer able to travel visa-free easily, or if it becomes more expensive or difficult for them to spend longer than 3 months in a member state in order to care for either an elderly parent or a sick child or someone else. And it's particularly families in lower socioeconomic status who could benefit from family reunification the most in order to have more resources within the family, financial resources, or to have more capacity for caregiving and these sorts of things. So definitely in countries, in EU member states where there are fewer in-home care options or a less developed healthcare system, it could be that British family members suffer if they do fall into some kind of illness.
I think one of the things that you've highlighted through this discussion today is some of the evidence gaps that exist and what knowledge we have that can fill some of them. Are there things that you think haven't been addressed yet or about which we really have very, very sketchy or poor knowledge that relate to issues around British families?
Yeah, well, I think as I mentioned in the beginning, we don't know how many third country national family members are attached to these sort of primary British free movement exercisers. So that's a huge disadvantage when it comes to the size of the population that we're talking about who will be impacted by Brexit. Because if we're only referring to the number of EU citizens, that's actually far short of the entire population of those impacted. It's only in particular member states where they release their micro data on the nationality of the partners of British citizens. So, for example, in France and in Germany, there is some data on the nationality of partners, which shows that actually a quite a significant proportion of UK nationals with partners are in relationships with someone who has the nationality of the host member state. And that could be important in terms of naturalizing in that host member state, because it's usually much easier for someone with who's married to a national to do so. So that kind of data would also be helpful, I think, in this debate. But as I've said, that isn't publicly available for most member states. I'm not sure if it's available privately, but in terms of researchers being able to do the heavy legwork on this, we're really at a loss.
I think that's been my experience all the way through this project, of there being significant evidence gaps in even kind of basic level understandings of who British citizens are who live abroad and what the conditions are under which they're living and working in the places that they've settled. So I'm glad I'm not alone in that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast, hosted by me, Dr. Michaela Benson, and produced by Emma Halton at Art of Podcast. The series is part of a UK and a Changing Europe funded research project, Brexit Brits Abroad, that's all about what Brexit means for UK citizens living in the EU27. We're really keen to hear from you about the issues and concerns we address.